This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Love Conquers All, Power Couples That Destroyed the Story.
So before we start this week, we just want to give you a warning that we will be discussing spoilers for a number of different books, simply because we're obviously looking at the end of those books. And included among them is the Sarah J. Maas novella, A Court of Frost and Starlight. But before we start discussing any books, obviously, we will give you a little heads up so that you can skip ahead to the next bit. So really, we came up with this episode so that we could discuss Court of Frost and Starlight. And I suggested it because I felt like Jules really needed to talk about it. We both read it, and we have slightly varying opinions about it, but we do agree on a couple of things. And Jules sent me her, rather Jules said that her review for A Court of Frost and Starlight was a little scalding. Sorry, was a little scathing, rather. And I went, oh, okay, I'm going to go check it out. And Jules really needs to reevaluate what a little scathing means, because it was salty. It was just sheer salt. Like, it was Dead Sea levels of salt. Yeah, all the kind of the little qualms that I'd had about the novella, Jules just tore into it. So I felt like we needed to discuss this novella. So for anyone else who's read it and enjoyed it, I'm just going to put it out there that I actually did enjoy reading it at the end of the day. But we hope that you're not offended by what is about to come.
Yeah.
So Jules, in one sentence or in a word, can you describe your reading experience of A Court of Frost and Starlight?
In one word.
One word.
Asinine.
Asinine. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Well, okay, for a start, it should have been called A Court of Sex and Shopping. It was literally like, it was like reading, I mean, did anyone ever used to watch Sex in the City? Which, basically, my response to Sex in the City was, what the hell is she wearing? Every single time. I wasn't going, what the hell is she wearing with this novella, but it gave me the same feeling, as in, it's full of vacuous people doing pointless things. So that's how I felt about it. As a caveat, I will just say that I can understand why people enjoyed it and why they liked reading it and why they, you know, they can't wait for the next one. I was one of those people who really, really, believe it or not, I went into it really wanting to be wrong. I went into it wanting it to be better than A Court of Wings and Ruin for me.
Mm-hmm.
But, unfortunately, I'm just not sold on the fandom enough for it to counteract the fact that it was missing things like a plot. That was a big issue for me. And, you know, I totally get it. As a little sidebar here, a number of people were not happy that Harry Potter and Deathly Hallows became two films because they said nothing really happened in the first film. I don't entirely agree with that, but I understand where that's coming from. And to be honest, I would have watched another three films just of them wandering around the moors, because that is how sold I am on that fandom. So I totally get it. But I get how that's not for everybody else. And that's kind of how I feel about this, I guess.
Yeah, it was definitely a bridge. And it was supposed to be. I mean, that's, you know, what it was advertised as. It was going to be a bridge between this and the new series, which is going to come out, where basically she's putting Faye Sand to bed, as it were. They've now got their happily ever after, and it's going to concentrate on those secondary characters. So that was the purpose behind the novella. Personally, I was just desperately upset that Lucien only appeared for like one very small bit. I think one thing that you and I agree on, really, in terms of this novella, was the almost now toxic relation, not toxic, but as in the very annoying relationship now between Rhysand and Feyre.
Yeah.
Which the way that their behavior has changed because of each other. And it ties in with basically throughout the book, the novella, you know, it's recognized that there are several characters who are going through some extreme stuff. I'll start with Lucien and we'll go on to Nesta. But Lucien, for instance, right at the beginning, it says that Lucien goes to see Tamlin, and when he comes back, he's got a black eye and a split lip, and he doesn't talk about it. And they never discuss that, which really angers me, because you have this whole... At the same time, you have Rhysand saying, oh, I'll never forgive Lucien for not helping you in the Spring Court. And I'm like, yes, but we literally have time after time a demonstration of Feyre being willfully ignorant or willfully ignoring the physical and emotional abuse that Lucien has been going through.
Yeah. Basically, this feeds into is that if it's not happening to Feyre, it doesn't matter. It's not abuse. No one else is suffering. And that is what comes across in the last book, and it comes across in the novella as well.
Yeah. Now, my hope is that basically, actually, we're seeing these characters at their very worst. And then the following series is going to be about them rebuilding themselves with their own sort of help, rather than it being about Feyre and Rhysand being responsible for them, which could be very, very good. But seeing everything from Feyre's and Rhysand's point of view has started to get a little tedious.
It has. Sorry, carry on.
Well, no, because I'm going to sort of bring this into the subject for today. And it is because of their relationship, because they seem to just be now the same person, really, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's the whole Bridget Jones thing of smug marrieds, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which, you know, is said, obviously, by Helen Fielding. It's said in a very tongue-in-cheek way and with a certain amount of bitterness by Bridget herself, in the sense of, you know, once people get together, that's it, and unless something goes horribly wrong, you know, you may as well just be talking to one of them rather than two people, and from the outside it can look very exclusive, and I suppose some romantic relationships can really look like that.
Yeah.
But the problem is that this entire series has thrived not on conflict from external influences, but on internal conflict, which she resolved in the second book. And therefore, there was no conflict really in the third book because she didn't concentrate on it. And there was definitely no conflict in the novella, which didn't really have a plot, as I said. It could have been a prologue.
You're exactly right. And, you know, just as you said before, you know, from the outside looking in, it can look very exclusive. But we're not from the outside looking in. We're seeing it from their point of view. And it's gotten to the point that Feyre still has a character. It's a character that I'm not particularly fond of anymore. She's become quite sanctimonious, a little self-centered, really. I'm still a little bit more fond of her than you are, I think, Jules. But Rhysand's character's just been taken away, and the conflict that they have between them, that they had some great conflict in book two, and suddenly it's all resolved. And the thing that annoys me is the fact that she turns 21 in the book. She turns 21 in the novella, and she's got it all sorted out, which really, I'm a little bit like, wait a second, what? You're 21 years old. Like, I'm 26 right now. I have no idea what's happening at any given point. You know, like, I don't even know what I'm going to be eating tonight. Okay, that's my level of disorganization. Now, obviously, I appreciate the fact that most people have it together a little bit more than me in that respect. But I still feel like she's way too young to suddenly have everything sort of all set out. And the other thing that you're reminded of is that the events of the books happened in a very, very short period of time. Now, yeah. Rhysand and Feyre, you know, they mated and they accepted their mating bond, which I was like, that's great, okay. But then they got married very quickly, and I thought, well, I guess, okay, if you're mated
for life anyway,
you're mated for life anyway, you might as well get married. That's fair enough. But now they're like, yeah, we're going to try for a child. And I was just, they're like, whoa!
I was just like, what the fuck? The other thing is the fact that Risund is 500 years old. I mean, so he's had plenty of time to think, you know what, I think I'm ready for a couple of little sproglets. But Feyre's 21. She hasn't even been in this stable relationship for a year yet. There's all this stuff that's been happening. You know, the war has not completely died down, or the aftermath hasn't. Yeah. Is now the time for a child?
And you can kind of understand her reasoning, basically. You know, she's having seen all these horrors, she's suddenly thinking, why am I waiting? But because she hasn't had that, you know, she still lived a mortal life for a very, very long period of time. And even though she knows that she's, you know, not immortal, but even though she knows that she's going to, you know, live for an incredibly long period of time now, the way her brain works and the way that she's set is still on that very short-lived human life that she had before. So I can kind of understand her suddenly having this panic and thinking, yeah, we should have kids. But I feel like we should have had a little bit of conflict of her saying, we should have kids, and Reese saying, whoa,
slow down.
No, we don't need to do this right yet. And I think that that would have been really good, because we would have then sort of had that conflict between the two of them desperately loving each other, but having a disagreement about the timings, because Reese has got a context that Feyre doesn't. Reese has been through a war when Feyre hasn't. Reason's much older than her. You know what I mean? And you even get in the novella, he goes, oh my god, I can't believe she's 21. And then, like, a few days later, he's like, yeah, let's have kids. And I was like, okay, you should not be agreeing on everything. You really, really shouldn't. And I think the problem is the idea that if a couple disagree on something, it can't be true love. Which annoys me, because it's just simply not the case. Two people being together all the time, and especially in the fact that they're always in each other's minds as well, okay?
Which is...
There should be bumps in the roads and disagreements, and that's not indicative of a relationship which isn't functioning. It's indicative of two people being individuals and functioning in that way.
Yeah.
So I really don't understand why all of that dynamic between them has been removed, and also why it's then perceived as more romantic, because for me it isn't more romantic. They've just become a single entity, which is really kind of annoying.
And it's how it's been done as well. It's been done in the way of Risan's personality has been completely sublimated by Feyre's. Completely and utterly. He exists to basically look at her and think he wants to fuck her and, you know, give her whatever she wants. And there is very little else. And it's incredibly frustrating. So I've gone literally from, wow, the first book, Risan's kind of a tool, but he's an interesting character, to, okay, he's actually possibly a decent guy. I'm not sure I buy the fact that everything he did was completely unselfish, because that's just another extreme that Sarah J. Maas has done.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I was kind of rooting for them. And then the third book, I was just like, shut the fuck up. Let someone else have the mic. Seriously. And this one, it was kind of like, I kind of want to, like, bash my head through a wall to get everything that I'm reading out of it, but I can't stop because I need to know what happens so that hopefully the next book is slightly better.
Yeah. And I think this is the other thing, is the fact that they are too perfect now. And even when they do things wrong, it's forgiven. Like, Risund goes and is pretty awful to Tamlin. And I can actually understand why Risund will never forgive Tamlin, and is, you know, it will be awful to him, because Tamlin is responsible for the death of his mother and his sister.
Yeah, he's one of the few people who's got a genuine reason to actually hold a grudge for all of eternity.
Yeah, exactly. But the thing is, like, I can kind of understand Feyre sort of saying, yeah, I understand why you did that. But basically she goes, well, you know, you're so good all of the time, it's okay that you got a bit angry. And I was a little bit like, I feel like, okay, that's something that a supportive, you know, partner might do, considering she knows the history. But I really do feel like this is why we need Lucian to come in and just say, what the hell? And he does, to a certain extent, you know, he says to Feyre, you know, you realize you're going to need Tamlin at some point, so could you not be such an idiot? But it was so short-lived, and Lucian was kind of really scoffed at, and it was really sort of pushed down, and we were never really given a sense of consequence at all. Like, Reason will never have to face any real consequence. And that's just been the way it's been developing. Sorry, this is just turning into an incredibly long rant about A Court of Stars.
No, this stuff needs to come out, and I haven't even started yet.
But yeah, so there's just this complete lack of consequence, because ultimately, even when they make the wrong decisions, it's forgiven. And they never really have to face the fallout of that properly.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just... It pisses me off beyond belief what they've done with Tamlin. I mean, yes, I felt that she went in an interesting direction with the second book. It wouldn't necessarily have been one I went in, but it went in an interesting direction. But there doesn't ever seem to be any middle ground. There's no nuance in her characters. They're either the devil or they're like so perfect you can't believe it, or that, you know, varying shades of, they're not quite as perfect as her golden darlings at the top, but you know, they're pretty close. And it's a case of every good thing that Tamlin ever did is now being, you know, it's been shaded with selfishness, and that wasn't necessarily the case at all. And it's kind of like, well, we're going to just skip over the fact that Feyre did genuinely love him, because that means that she couldn't properly love Rhysand. And if the only way that you can build up a male character who was a rival to is by tearing the other one down, then they're not that good. They really aren't.
I agree. The other thing is that there was almost a level of closure after the third book, which I appreciated, where Tamlin sort of gives some of his power up to bring Rhysand back, and he just says, "I just want you to be happy, Feyre."
Yeah, but we're skipping over that.
Yeah, and then they say, we don't care if you did that. And I just think, you should care. That was a significant thing. Because, at the end of the day, you don't really know, actually, the circumstances of how Tamlin gave up Rhysand's mother and sister. You don't know how that happened. You don't know if it was forced out of him. You don't know if, you know, he was being pressured. He was younger than Rhysand and he was trying to prove something. You really don't understand what happened there. You don't understand the regret that he might have gone through or anything like that. And at the end of the day, Rhysand's father also killed his mother.
Yeah.
There was two things there. And I'm not saying there should be forgiveness between the two of them, but there was a settlement, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And now Tamlin's been left in this really desperate state in which the only person who seemed to recognize that he was genuinely suffering and that he had been through something awful as well is Lucien, who's kind of treated as a fool for going back to his abuser, when actually that's a very natural thing to do. And that's actually what Feyre did as well. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing we need to get away from is the fact that Tamlin is just an abuser. He's not. He's someone who was suffering basically PTSD as well. And he processed it really badly, and he processed it by trying to control everyone else around him because he's finally got his power back.
Yeah. And he was, I think the important thing is that he was abusive, but he wasn't, he's never been a bad person. As in, like, the way that he was described in the beginning. You know, when everything was hopeless, he was kind. That was, you know, what he was kind. And actually, he didn't really want that kind of power to begin with. He wanted to be a wandering minstrel. You had this character who was complicated. And yeah, he was a bit, I didn't really like some of the romance between them. But he was a complicated character, and he wasn't a bad person. He'd just been through something, and that doesn't excuse the bad things that he did, but it also doesn't mean that he should just be thrown to the wayside and completely abandoned. And any hope of character development for him, and any hope of change and you know, making a difference. And I think that was the thing that really annoyed me in the third book, and that was the thing that really annoyed me in this novella, was that you completely... it was just this, well, no, he must be 100% bad because he's done this one, you know, he's done these bad things, so he's 100% bad. And then Tamlin turns around and says, did you really think that just because you left me, I'd suddenly side and want to take humans as slaves again.
Yeah. Yeah, it was ridiculous.
You know, did you really think that I'd want humans as slaves again just because you left me? And it's really kind of annoying because I guess because we see it from Feyre's point of view, we are very tinted by Feyre's opinion. And she does see things in an incredibly black and white way. So I do wonder how much of that is Sarah J. Maas and how much is Feyre as a character. And I think there's a little bit of blurring between the two things, but I also still hold out hope that actually Maas will correct this and flip things around in future books.
Yeah.
You do not sound certain.
I don't. I'm doubtful. I think Feyre started off as a different character and it became a self-insert for Sarah J. Maas, basically. And I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with that, but I don't think she knows herself well enough to put herself in a book.
Yeah. The other thing is that actually I can sort of appreciate why things went a little bit baby crazy in the novella. It is because Sarah J. Maas did get pregnant during that time.
Yeah, I heard that, and that just kind of made me roll my eyes even more. Not that she was pregnant, because fine, great, life choices and everything, but the fact that you then have to impose that on your art was kind of, that's not drawing on your
pregnant,
life experiences.
I'm pregnant, we all have to be pregnant.
Well, yeah, because what her novels continually keep saying, and it's something I keep ignoring and it keeps coming back to me, is that her life experiences are valid and everybody else's aren't.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that kind of, that grates my cheese slightly. yeah, we should probably get off this one slightly at some point. But I will just say I don't like the way they're going with Nesta either, because it doesn't fit the character as she's been portrayed before. However, it is slightly more interesting.
It is.
I hate the way that the character is being treated by everybody else, because how utterly heartless do they have to be? You know?
Yeah. You're completely right.
Because Nesta's basically had her, you know, Nesta and Elaine never really got the chance to stop hating fairies before they became one. So yeah. Nesta's not processing this very well. She's done an awful lot of good things. I hate the way that they give the attribute, the kill of the King of Highburn to Elaine. Elaine stabbed him. Nesta cut his fucking head off.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's be a little bit reasonable there. And then the fact that, you know, there's all this, okay, I'm going to really rant now, but there's all this bullshit in the book and in this little prequel bit we get of the next book, whereby Cassian's like, we're supposed to be admiring him because he's not making a fuss about the fact somebody else took her virginity.
Yeah.
I was going to say, this is one of the most toxic things I've ever read. I hate the fact that this keeps coming up in YA and new adult fiction. I really do.
Yeah. The way I chose to read it, and it was a conscious decision, that, because I agree with you, it's a very toxic message, and I just wanted to kind of correct it for myself, is that Cassian is feeling odd about it because he knows Nesta, and he knows that this is not a Nesta would have done before, giving up, you know, sort of having sex before marriage or anything like that. That's the kind of thing that Nesta really sneered at. Nesta was also, I believe there's a piece of fiction somewhere by Sarah J. Maas which actually acknowledges the fact that Nesta might have been sexually abused at some point,
right,
or might have been abused by that guy who proposed to her when they were all very, very poor. So I like to come at it from that angle and say that Cassian is looking at it and sort of thinking, Nesta has given up part of it's part of her identity. Not that, you know, having sex and losing virginity makes you any less of anything else, but because it's Nesta. And this is just not something that Nesta would do. And, you know, we look at Feyre, and Feyre happily had lost her virginity before the start of book one. And Nesta sneered at that. She really did sneer at that. So for Nesta to then completely turn around, and not in a positive way, she's not doing this because she suddenly found her own sexuality, as it were. She's doing it because she's trying to drown out the trauma that she's been through. And so that's why I have Cassian going, I don't like this, because this is not you, but I respect that it's your decision. That's how I decided to read it. But yeah, to be frank, actually, there is a little bit of that whole sort of, how dare she lose her virginity to anyone else but me? But I can, again, kind of understand Cassian, because, you know, Nesta did lie over him while he was bloody and about to die, and said, yeah, we'll go together. We'll die together. And then she completely cut him out afterwards. So I can understand why he's a bit frustrated. But yeah, I'm not for that whole sort of the virgin message. Really.
It was the whole line about he was saying that he deliberately didn't find out who had done it.
Yeah.
Who had robbed him of it, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that really bothers me. And then the whole the cliche blood on the sheets type thing. And it's just, oh, anyway, that's a complete minefield, but it's just, I think it's a sexist social construct. It means what it means to the person. It doesn't mean anything else, and it really needs to be dropped out of YA fiction, particularly when someone thinks they're so woke about sex positivity.
Yeah. Here's something else that we should probably discuss. Sex. Sex, 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 sex. Don't know why I had to say that several times, but I just felt like we needed to get it out. We need to discuss how sex is used in relationships. And the fact that the sex is always mind-blowing. The sex is always mind-blowing in the in A Court of Thorns and Roses.
Yeah,
when it's recent and Feyre just have the most mind-blowing sex, which kind of makes me feel a little bit sort of like, I guess, you know, if you're 500 years old, then you really should be relatively good at sex. If you've been having it for that long, you should probably be able to please your partner quite well. But at the same time, I just think that with every partner, there's going to be different things, isn't there? And actually,
generally,
sex isn't always going to be the most orgasmic thing in the entire bloody universe, you know?
No.
And it's not always going to end in an orgasm, both for the male or the female. It doesn't always end like that. It really doesn't have to end in an orgasm, doesn't always happen. And that's okay. You can just stop. Before you reach that point. So I'm just getting a little bit sort of like, and that's kind of normal. Also, like, sex is really funny if you think about it. It's really, really funny. So, like, there are going to be odd noises, and you're going to bonk your head somewhere, you know, as you move up to the one thing I really liked in the Loch Lomora series, the Gentleman Bastard sequence, is that in book three, they talk about Locke and Sabatha having sex for the first time.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're actually not very good at it, and they're both kind of frustrated because they're both virgins and they're having sex for the first time. And they're kind of like, yeah. And then it kind of ends and it's really dissatisfying. And they're like, it doesn't matter. We can just try it again another point. But it's the fact that there's this line where Locke says, having sex in real life with one isn't the same as, you know, having sex dreams, because women in real life have weight to them and you can't always so, you know, changing positions, pausing, so we really need to examine this message that we get in YA and NA, which basically says, when you find the perfect partner, the sex will just fall into place, because that's totally unrealistic. And even though, God, I do love reading a little bit of smut here and there, it's also quite nice to see the reality of what putting two biological organisms together naked, or semi-naked, in a bed together, will, you know, how it'll turn out. Because actually, it doesn't always turn out with the most explosive orgasm of life in the entire universe. And that doesn't mean that you aren't good for each other, and that doesn't mean that it's not a good relationship. So
yeah, and I have to say, that's for all I was sort of agonizing about writing a sex scene that was actually going to be read by anybody, it's something where I thought, if there's one time where you're going to say the wrong thing, the thing that's not romantic or seductive, it's going to be in the run up to that, or perhaps during. So
yeah,
I had both Em and Kieran both saying the wrong thing all the
yeah.
way through, pretty much.
Also them getting impatient with one another.
Oh god, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Matt made a joke about Kieran having to stop and think about the cricket, and I said, well, actually, if you read that scene, it's really Em who needs to stop and think about the cricket. Because she's seriously not going to be diverted from her course at that point.
Yeah. And I'm just trying to think of examples. We haven't had a real sex scene in Hamartia Cycle yet. And in fact, for the very large amount of sex scenes that I've written, none of them have actually appeared in any of my books.
Yeah, it's weird that, really, because I hear about them. They don't materialise.
They've just been for my own pleasure. And yeah, I love a little bit of smart here and there. And you know, the point is that it is meant to be fantasy. But I think, you know, there's a place for sexual fantasy in literature. And there's also, when it comes to YA and when it comes to new adults and romance, it's nice to have, you know, sex that works out really, really great. But it's also nice to actually show that it's not indicative of a good relationship necessarily.
No. You know, ideally the good relationship should come first, and then, you know, perhaps the satisfying sexual experience sort of comes with a bit of practice afterwards. But it doesn't have to be negative either. It can just be sort of like, oh, well, it's okay, but
yeah, exactly. And it's, as you say, it doesn't need to be negative. And again, one of the things I liked about The Lies of Locke Lamora is that you had Sabatha and Locke who were having had sex for the first time when they were both sort of 16, 17. And they were like, oh, that wasn't very good. And Locke was there like, oh god, I've really messed this up. And Sabatha was there like, oh, don't worry, we'll try it again. And then, you know, there's a brief line again about the fact that they try it again, and then they sort of actually realise the merit of giving things a second go, because then they start to have fun. And yeah, sex can sometimes just be fun. It doesn't need to be mind-blowing. You can just have some fun.
Yes, it doesn't have to be sort of like the entire universe rearranges itself.
Yeah, mountains shake and...
I think the thing is, you can have... I'm trying not to go too personal here, actually, but this is a case of, you know, for a long time, it's like kissing was way better. As in, you could, not all the time, but with certain people, it was like, wow, that was almost an earth-moving kiss type thing. But
yeah,
I think you kind of have to be in a place where you're quite comfortable with the other person.
Yeah. And again, and this is the other thing, is that different people will respond to different things. Like for me, I like kissing, but actually I've never really had a kiss and thought, wow, this has changed my entire life. And it's never really been, you know, like I'm okay with kissing. Actually, for a while, I hated kissing completely. I really didn't enjoy it.
Oh yeah, it's gross. It's like two slugs mating, you know.
Yeah, it's super disgusting. and so every now and then I'd been reading novels like The Kiss, and it changed everything. I was like, what?
What are you talking about?
It's just wet and cold and gross.
and then you're like, sort of, there's one or two, and you think, actually, I can kind of see what they're going on about there.
yeah. You start kissing the right people, and you're like, actually, this is kind of nice. I admit, this is kind of nice, and it's a little bit soft, and I can get behind that. But it is. It's just about the reality of it. And I think that's particularly important in YA fiction, because this is a time when young women and young men are, and young people, are basically discovering themselves and discovering their sexuality, And it sends a really bad message, just along with, you know, the whole virgin thing. It sends a really, really negative message, because basically it completely ignores the fact that you have to learn to be good at sex.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, unless you really...
It's not an inherent skill.
No, and I can see the whole sort of, if you have two people who are both virgins together, it's kind of like, they were kind of like, well, it was all right, but I guess we could have had a game of tennis kind of thing. And it might potentially be better if you've got one person who really knows what they're doing and yeah. someone who doesn't. But even then, it, you know, it's still a bit more hit and miss. As in, the real problem with the A Court of Thorns and Roses series is the fact that it's fallen flat now from the third book, as far as I'm concerned, because Rhysand and Feyre, as you say, are too perfect together. And there's no conflict in the relationship, and that conflict was driving the series, and now nothing, there's no conflict really to drive it.
Yeah.
Which, you know, if that happens, then, you know, where romance has been the focus, you've got three choices, really. Mm. You either need to introduce a new conflict much, much earlier on, which gradually takes the place as the romance starts to work itself out.
Yeah.
Which hasn't been done, unfortunately. And ideally, it should be an external conflict as well. Or you finish with that couple and you retire them and perhaps move your tier two characters up, which I think is what she's going to do.
Yeah.
Or you end the series, you know, and you move on and you write something else.
Yeah. The thing which kind of annoys me is the idea that actually when a couple get together, that needs to be the end. And that conflict or conflict is resolved just because you're together. And then what really annoys me actually is when, in order to create conflict, especially when you've had a series which has had the whole will they, won't they kind of dynamic, and they get together and then they're like, oh no, you know, this is too boring now. We need to create the conflict of, oh no, he cheated on her, or they're having problems or stuff like that. And it needs to be earth shattering. I'm going to give you an example of a series which proves that you can have the two main characters getting together and still completely have a series that functions, and that's Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Yeah.
Where you have Amy Santiago and Jake Peralta, who get together and are getting married this season, and somehow it's like, that hasn't changed anything. The dynamic between them is exactly the same as it was before. Well, a little bit better, as in they kind of hated each other. I say hated each other. They had this sort of real rivalry going on in the first series, and they still kind of do. But it just goes to show that actually it's okay. You can have the couple get together and still have things working, and you can have conflict within that relationship without it being the be-all and end-all just about whether they are going to remain together. It's possible to have conflict in a relationship which isn't about them finishing the relationship or starting the relationship.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that they got wrong with Friends, really, wasn't it? They didn't know where to go after they put Ross and Rachel together. And therefore you had the whole sort of, we're going to break up, we're going to cheat on each other, et cetera, et cetera. And it just got stupid. And this is kind of a subject that's close to my heart, because I wasn't supposed to be writing another Unveiled book. I was supposed to be writing a novella. The novella currently stands at 110,000 words, and it's going to be about another 20,000. So it's going to be about the same length as the first book.
I loved it, because you're like, I'm writing a novella. I'm like, it's going to be a book, isn't it? And you're like, no, it's going to be a novella. And I was like, it's going to be a book. And you're like, no, no, you'll see. And yes. As usual.
Sheepish tweet saying, yeah, so it's a book, guys, but it's not part of the main Unveiled arc, because I really genuinely have closed that. It's just a case of, this is kind of a companion novel, which, you know, is how I'm marketing it. But the whole potential spoilers, if you haven't read all the way through Unveiled here, it explores the whole sort of idea of what happens next, you know. I wasn't going for the whole happily ever after vibe, but I closed it so that the couple that ideally you root for end up together. And in no way do all their problems completely end there, but their problems are different. They've shifted focus.
Yeah.
So, and I will say absolutely from the start, it's not a case of one person goes and cheats or anything like that, or they start eyeballing other people. That's not what happens.
Yeah. I mean, the thing I like about this relationship is the fact that they argue, and they have, and they come from very different sides. But these are two people who are committed to making this work despite the problems of their own lives, which has always kind of been what the relationship is about, which is why I've always enjoyed it.
I mean, some people really, really did ship M with Lucas, and I can kind of understand it, but it would have been a shit show, in my opinion. having written an alternate ending.
Straight from the author's mouth! From the author's mouth! Take that, Matt! Matt, I appreciate you very, very much, but I will go down with this ship.
I mean, it's one of those things that there were both external and internal things. I don't think ultimately it would have been a healthy relationship. And you have to start from the perspective that actually, in some respects, Em and Kieran aren't a very healthy relationship to start with. They have, you know, part of I Rule the Night is unpacking that and working out exactly what makes for a healthy, more adult relationship. And then I suppose Betwixt and Between, which is the novella that turned into a novel when I wasn't looking, is really about looking at the fallacy of the happy ever after.
Yeah.
Because there's no such thing, really. I mean, it's a nice thing to think of in the sanitized fairy tale sense, in the fantasy book sense, but it's not. I mean, relationships take work, and there are going to be times when you're both just being really stupid and dense, and that's why you have a misunderstanding about something.
Yeah, and the other thing is that conflict comes in all sorts of different ways, but for the most part, my experience is that arguments will arise about the dumbest things ever. And it's just because if two people spend a lot of time together, there's going to be tiny little things that grate, and then one day you're going to come in and you're going to see that someone hasn't put something on the draining board, they've just put it on the side. And you're like, oh my god, what do you think the draining board is for? I cannot believe you won't use the draining board. You know, that side is where you cook. Why have you left cutlery there? Oh my god. And then you start an argument.
Yeah. And and the thing is, it's the tiny little things. The tiny things are the spark.
Yeah.
And they're the spark that actually ignite the big things that are underneath that nobody's really wanted to bring up yet, because they know it's going to be a big overhaul and both sides are going to have to change their perspectives a little bit.
Yeah. But the other thing is that actually the big thing underneath may not have anything to do with the relationship at all. Like one of the dynamics that we get in Unveiled is that actually the underlying issue for Kieran and for Em is actually the thing that's really bothering them is actually to do with the horrors that they're facing. Em is constantly being dogged by the undead, basically.
Yes.
But by a mystery that she has to solve. And that is often a huge part of the conflict, and the conflict that she's having with her sisters, and the conflict that she's having with Lucas. You know, these are all things that play into her arguments with Kieran, in that actually the way they behave around each other isn't just about each other, it's about the bigger things. And then you have Kieran as well, and Kieran who is dealing with his father and his abusive background, and his jealousy, and the fact that he's always felt like he's not good enough in some ways, and then the fact that he's realizing that certain characteristics about himself are not actually that attractive. You know, the fact that he's maybe a little bit too charming sometimes, which is a bad thing because he keeps leading women on without realizing that he's leading them on.
Yeah.
You know, these are all big things which are playing into it. And again, just using Rhysand and Feyre as an example, we just don't get that. The conflict that they have, because they don't really seem to be, it doesn't feed into sort of their relationship at all, because they both just understand. And actually, communication takes work. And the other thing about communication is that you may not always understand why. And God knows, I'm getting personal here, but God knows the amount of times that I've turned around and I've been furious with Sean about something, and he'll turn around and say, this is about such and such. you know, this is about your mother, or this is about this, that, or the other. And I'll stop and I'll go, yeah, actually, this is about that. And it's nothing to do with you using the draining board or not.
Yeah.
It was one time. I really don't know why I got so upset. I'm a terrible house mate to live with. I'm the messiest, most disgusting human being in the world. So really, I have no right to be angry about a draining board. But anyway, the point is that actually communication takes work. And that's what I really, really like about Kieran and Em's relationship. And actually why, for me, despite the fact that some people could say, oh, it falls into the similar kind of tropes, you got the love triangle, but it wasn't. Because actually, you really, really managed to show a proper complicated relationship, which was being influenced by external and internal sources, basically.
Yeah, thank you. That's what I was going for. Yeah, the
well, you did it.
The love triangle aspect is a case of, well, Em's pretty clueless there. She doesn't want to realise that Lucas is interested. And to be fair, he has told her he's not.
Yeah.
Which is a lie, clearly.
Which was a lie.
It was a bit of sophistry anyway. And, you know, he was scheming away. And Kieran does sort of see it. But Kieran betrays himself there as well. And part of the problem is he's never really been this committed to anybody. So the idea of that being taken away sort of feeds into the whole sort of abandoned child complex that he didn't even really know he had.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, once Em really works it out, yeah, she doesn't say, oh, I just want to be friends. She says, I can't be friends with you because you want more. This can't work. It doesn't matter what I want. I can see now I've been selfish. I can't do this.
Yeah.
And completely cuts off contact, quite brutally, actually. it was quite a difficult scene. That's the whole point. It's like there was never really another, it couldn't really have gone in a different direction. Or there's the potential there, but you can see it kind of wouldn't fit, I think. And this next book, which will be out at some point this year, is just a case of not everything is perfect in paradise just because they still do have their hang-ups and things that they need to work past, and that's a lifetime commitment, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And life will always throw new things at you, and it will change you. So so other than Unveiled and Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I'm trying to think of a good example of a series of books or films which have managed to put the main couple together and still actually keep the series going, and then an example of a series which has completely failed with that.
Okay, well, I've got one for the former, and you know, I think this is probably a lot of people are going to disagree with me here, but Twilight, actually, for all its problematic content, you get the two of them together for the fourth book. And the conflict has changed. I mean, initially there's the conflict of the fact she might be dying to have a child, literally. And then because she's had the child, all the Volturi come after them. But, you know, the conflict is still there. Whatever it is that needs to drive the books is still there. And it was introduced early enough in the series, in the second book, in fact, so that it didn't just come out of left field and it wasn't a case of, oh, well, they're together now, we need to find something else. So they're together. And as far as them being together and, you know, personally working together, they're happy. But there is all this external stuff, so it doesn't kill the series. I think if it had gone on any longer, it probably would have done.
Yeah. I would like to point out that actually one could technically argue that in A Court of Thorns and Roses, actually there was another plot that was coming into it, which was the whole Highburn thing.
Yeah. It was so weakly developed, though.
You just don't want to give it a break.
Well, actually, I kind of really do, because I thought the second book was one of the best ones I'd ever read.
Yeah.
But because the focus was so much on the romance all the time, with the Highburn plot and everything, really only making up about sort of 10% of it, it needed to make up at least a quarter to a third to really sort of pull its weight, and it just didn't. And I know I'm very, very picky about book structure. That's one of my bugbears, but...
Well, you know what you want. Which isn't a bad thing. But my God, do I never want to get a bad review from you, because Jules... Jules, you're... That review. I'm still reeling from it. I choked on my tea. I was laughing so hard.
I actually didn't think it was that bad. I'm generally only really scathing when someone's been lazy, in my opinion.
I don't want to read a review. You found someone who's been lazy. My God! Oh, you could set someone on fire with your words. A woman scorned.
To give Sarah J. Maas a bit of fair props here, she is writing against an incredible amount of pressure from her fans.
She is.
The more hyped a book, I've noticed, the more hyped a book is, the worse it seems to hit all the things that I want out of it. And I want things like a good structure. I want the characters to pull their weight. I want the storylines to pull their weight. I don't want everything to be perfect between the main couple. But it's very noticeable that when it's really hyped, that it misses all those things, because what she's feeding there is what she thinks all her fans want, I think.
Yeah.
And that is a potential downfall of fan service.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, I'm actually going to put it out and say, I actually enjoyed reading A Court of Frost and Starlight, and I actually enjoyed A Court of Wings and Ruin. I know you didn't, but I did. I liked reading them. I liked the story. I liked the way that it was developed. Yeah, I have some bugbears with it, and I can definitely punch some holes in it. But at the end of the day, it ticked the most important box for me, which is that it kept me engaged. I was engaged with what I was reading, and I still like most of the characters at the end of it. You know, it's not Wuthering Heights for me, where I was glad most of them were dead. So...
Even I get to the end of Wuthering Heights and I'm glad most of them are dead.
Oh, thank God. I wish more of you had died. I wish there was a plague. The last 100 pages are just descriptions of them all dying in horrible ways. And I'm like, ha ha.
The last 50 pages are an apocalyptic description of the Yorkshire Moor.
Exactly. I would read the hell out of that.
Wuthering Heights and zombies.
I mean, no, that's kind of what Wuthering Heights is, really. Just Kathy, except instead of disappearing off the moor, she just drags What's-His-Face out and eats him.
Well, okay, now I need to write that fanfiction.
Yes!
There are some people who wanted the series to end after the first book of A Court of Thorns and Roses, in fairness. I was talking to Gareth about it the other day, and he very much, I think, felt perhaps betrayed by the second book, because Tamlin had been so built up to be the love interest. And I'll admit, even for me, that sort of came out of left field a little bit. I liked the way it was done because it was quite intelligent in the second book, but I can understand why, if you'd really invested in that first couple, why the second book would just feel like a bit of a slap in the face, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. And I kind of do wish that it was actually, Gareth even asked me when I'd read the third book, he said, does Tamlin get a kind of redemption arc? Because otherwise I'm not going to read it. And I completely understand that why. So I really hope he doesn't read A Court of Frost and Starlight, because he will be so upset.
I mean, I think he said the same thing to me about A Court of Wings and Ruin. And I was like, well, yeah, if you get out your electron scanning microscope, it's kind of there.
Yeah.
But...
yeah, and I appreciate that. I really do appreciate that more now than ever. So,
everyone's feelings on reading a book, you know, are valid as long as you actually you read the book before you rate it, for example. And you even read it and said, because I was struggling to get through the novella because it was just pissing me off so much. But you even said, I'm reading it and I'm enjoying it, but I know you're going to hate it.
I was reading it. I was turning the page. I'm like, oh, Jules is going to hate this. Jules is going to hate this. I actually felt a genuine glee knowing how much you were going to hate it. Even as I consumed it and I was like, yeah, this is very nice, but I know this is... I cannot wait for this episode because Jules is going to erupt. So yeah, I've been looking forward to doing this episode for quite a while. And the point that actually we had other episodes planned and I said, no, let's do this one because I think, Jules, you need to get it out of your system.
Yeah, I mean, you're not wrong. And the thing is, a lot of my, I've got a whole bunch of reading buddies, and we didn't obviously read this one together, but it's noticeable that pretty much all of them gave it at least 3 stars or above and really enjoyed it. And my main reading buddy, Melanie, actually sort of said, well, I've given this 4 stars. It actually doesn't have a plot. I just really enjoyed, you know, visiting the world again. She's an experienced book blogger.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
It just goes to show, I mean, my opinion is not, you know, de rigueur for what everybody else should think about it. Definitely not. It didn't ring my bell, obviously.
Sorry, with all the talk about sex, it didn't ring my bells. It makes me laugh.
That people made so much fuss about that up against the wall sex scene, though. Did you find that? And instead, I was reading it, I was like, this is really tame. This is, like, really tame.
Yeah, I wasn't actually that, to be honest, yeah. It was a bit sort of, I enjoyed it. But, like, actually, I've read better sex.
I mean, sidebar, but the difficulty with young adult fiction is naming body parts during a sex scene. Have you not found that? There is absolutely no good synonym for clitoris, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
you have 2 options, really, and one is just to name body parts, and then it gets a bit anatomical, and it's like, gross. Or you fall into metaphor, and it's kind of like, what are they doing? Are there genuine white-capped waves here? What the hell? Or you just kind of like, and his hand went down there, and you're just like, what?
Down where?
It's down, like, where?
It was like, he sheathed himself in me, is one that... is one that Sarah J. Matthews, and I kind of like it, but at the same time I'm just there like, whoa.
I don't think there is any, like, excuse
with his penis, right? Not just
what, he had a sword?
He has a sword.
It's the excuse for this, and this is in Empire of Storms, which is a separate series, but she actually uses velvet wrapped steel as a euphemism for someone's erection. There is no excuse for that. No matter what you're writing.
I don't know. I actually feel like Sarah J. Maas does a good job of actually writing these very sexy scenes without actually using the words. I think she does a pretty good job of it.
I did think that, and then I saw somebody else's review where they described her as the Donald Trump of sex scenes. It's like,
oh, come on!
No, but it was such a funny review. It was a bit cruel, but it was also kind of close to the point. It's like, and he got out his thing, and it was the biggest thing ever. Yeah, right? It was the biggest thing ever. And it was just, it's just so vague, and I kind of get what they're saying.
Sorry, this is the other, just a small pet peeve. It's like, there's this whole thing about the Illyrians and how big their penises are. And I'm just there like, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be better sex. In fact, it's more likely to be uncomfortable. Like, really?
Yeah. the whole idea of, like, going on about them being really well hung and really muscular and everything. Does anybody want a slightly chubby, slightly shorter fey male to come along and... but be really, like, intelligent, witty, and get the girl? Or the boy?
Yeah, like, or the boy. Or you know, whatever. I do kind of want, like, a little bit of... I like a little bit of softness, actually.
Yeah.
Like, chiseled muscle. It's always the chiseled muscle. And I'm just there like, but what about soft boy? What about a soft girl?
To be honest, that doesn't really... Okay. Oh. We almost hit one of my kinks there. The whole sort of... Sorry. I'm not doing very well with keeping my thoughts inside my head today, am I? The whole overly chiseled muscle thing. It's like, yeah, that's fine if I'm looking at statuary, but otherwise...
It's kind of uncomfortable, actually.
I'm not really that bothered. And, you know, there's the whole sort of scene in the latest DC movie where you've got the Justice League, and I'm like, the guy, Jason Momoa, who plays Aquaman, I was like, kind of like, he does nothing for me whatsoever. I think he's quite funny and he's quite a good actor. doesn't do anything for me whatever. He puts on this ugly ass cable knit orange jumper, and I was like, wow.
It's you and the cable knit, isn't it? It's all about the cable knit for you.
It's knitwear. It's men in knitwear. I mean, the minute he took it off again, I was just like, yeah. And it genuinely was. It was like an on-off switch. There's something clearly wrong with me.
I like waistcoats.
Waistcoats?
I like waistcoats. I also like sweaters, but as in like nice sweaters. I like nice sweaters. It just makes them look homely. Yeah, and vests make them look, you know, gentlemanly and sort of Victorian.
I mean, just to complete my embarrassment, I mentioned this to Matt and he sort of laughed at the time, and then he was editing I Rule the Night and he gets to he was starting to get slightly irritated about sort of like Dreamboat Kieran kind of thing. And then in his edits, when he sent it back to me, I've got Kieran wearing a thick jumper, and I hadn't even noticed I'd put him in a thick woolly jumper. And Matt's like, well, no wonder he's so attractive. I'm like, oh my God, I'm so embarrassed. I didn't even realise I'd done that.
Yeah, no, it is like, yeah. Again, another thing I liked about Lies of Locke Lamora is that you have Jean Tannen, who is a who's described as fat, basically. And he loses some of that, but he's a big guy, and he's a very, very strong guy, and he's also, you know, the one who kind of does things, who does the physical labor, but he's also the really smart one. He's very intelligent, and it's because of that, you know, he's both strong and intelligent, that he actually ends up with a really lovely girlfriend in the second book, called Esri. And I kind of liked that, because actually you have Locke, who's the main character, who's the genius, as it were, who's pretty much useless at fighting, and is very small and is very thin, and like it's this consistent thing throughout. They're like, you really need to eat more, because he looks like he's on the verge of death, because he's just really, really small, because he was malnourished when he was younger, and he's always been tiny. And I really like the fact that these are unconventionally attractive people, in that the traits that are attractive, in that they're both, you know, they even say that neither of them are particularly handsome, but they're still desirable, and they're still characters that I like, and they're, you know, I can totally understand why people would fall in love with them. And I really like that. I just like the idea that you can have something that is attractive beyond how big your penis is, and how chiseled your muscles are, and that actually a little bit of softness is rather pleasant.
Yes, agreed.
And cable knit jumpers.
Okay, we clearly need to do another sex episode, because there's a rich vein of stuff here we haven't plumbed yet.
Really, you had to use that word?
Yeah, I shouldn't have used the word plumbed. I'm just going to go with it and pretend that I didn't. And I've lost you.
Well, I think actually we're coming to the end of the episode, and we've probably disturbed and upset all of our listeners, and made this incredibly, incredibly awkward. Yep. So before we go, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week, and this week Jules has got one for you.
Yeah, I just finished an advanced reader's copy of Mirage by Soumaya Daoud, which is Moroccan-based sci-fi fantasy.
Ooh.
And it's just absolutely brilliant. It's on the surface, it's a very, you know, you'll say, I've heard this story before, you know, girl part of disadvantaged background starts a revolution, etc. It's not really like that. It's, what makes it different is the fact that it really deals with things like cultural erasure, and it does it in a non-preachy, gentle way that really makes you look at it and is quite poignant and moving. And then if you add in the lore and the mythology and everything around it, and the fact that it's set in space, which is a little bit different as well, it's just a really intelligently well done book. It's not out until August, but I highly recommend everyone adds it to their to-be-read piles on Goodreads or wherever.
Okay. Thank you for that one. And on that note, guys, thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.